Andrea, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Lurgan Pride.
Very Lurgan Pride, bigging up the Lurgan.
You've been all over the world, but you're still Lurgan Pride.
Still very proud of Lurgan. And after this, I'll be straight back down to Lurgan again, so to see the family.
So whenever you hear the song Driving Home for Christmas, it's you flying down to Lurgan.
I am Chris Rea going down the M1 to Lurgan off of Junction 10. Very happy about it as well.
Unbelievable. Yeah. How did you first end up in America? Because I know you as one of the most connected Northern Irish people on the planet. I know you as Mrs. America. I know you as in the New York and all with the diaspora and everything. So how did you leave this fine place to begin with?
Well, actually, it goes right back to when I graduated from Queens. I graduated back in the 90s. When I was coming out of college, there really weren't any jobs at all. And in my penultimate year at Queens, I decided to go over to the Careers Fair in the Student Union. And I just had this vision of a really dark and dusty room walking in, and there was nothing there. You know, the Careers Fair literally was like one stand. And unless you wanted to be kind of the civil service, police, army, I think maybe with one of the kind of communications companies or something like that, there really wasn't much there. But there was one stand that had this program called the Pan Atlantic Program. And it was a government funded program that sent graduates out to America, specifically to Boston, to work on behalf of a company for Northern Ireland for 6 months. And I thought, right, that's what I want to do. And next year, when this comes around for my time, I'm going to apply to this program. Huh. And a year later, that's exactly what I did. And I'm very old, so it was you had to send away for the application. So when it appeared in the Belfast Telegraph, I immediately sent off for my form, and when the application came back, it was application number one. So I was very enthusiastic.
Keen.
Very keen.
And like, yeah. Would people listening who know you, they're like, yep, that's
it. Yeah, that'll be her.
You're really?
Sure. Yeah. But it's kind of like, it was a really convoluted story then sort of after that. But so I applied for it, graduated, no job. Like all of my sort of contemporaries, we all ended up on various programs or whatever afterwards. And I remember my mother sent word, I was living in the Holy Lands at the time, mother sent word to say, you've got an interview tomorrow morning with a company called Euroventure. And I'm like, I know I've been sending off tons of applications for just about everything, but I haven't applied to a company called Euroventure. I know that as well. You've got a interview tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And I duly dressed up my little dunce suit and went and stood by the bus stop to go to East Belfast for an interview that I didn't know what it was actually for. And of course, the next morning it was pouring down. Oof. All of the buses were going past. They were full. And I was like a drowned rat. And I ended up going to the interview an hour late and walking in and saying to the lady behind the desk, oh, I'm really sorry. You know, can I still be interviewed for this job that I really know nothing about? And she said, well, we'll see. You know, there's other people. This lady's here and she needs to be interviewed. And I sat down beside this other girl and said, have you any idea what this is for? And she said, oh, yeah, I think it's Pan Atlantic. Right.
Okay.
So,
but this was your big one then?
This is my big one.
And here you are.
I have no
idea. Wet as a dog.
Yeah, I look dreadful and hourly. All the things that you shouldn't do, I did. And went into the interview and apologized profusely to the interviewers. And they said, well, you know, tell us what you know about the program. So I duly talked about Pan Atlantic and they nodded and let me ramble on and then said, well, yeah, everything you said is correct, but this is San Francisco. Are you okay about going to San Francisco?
Whoa.
And so it was basically the program was up for renewal again and Euroventure were, I guess, bidding for the contract. And so they had chosen to go out west. And I thought, yeah, absolutely. So I ended up getting onto the program and representing a company from Carrickfergus that manufactured cable assemblies. So gritty stuff, and ended up out in San Francisco.
This episode is part of our ongoing series with NI Connections, where we interview an interesting person from Northern Ireland who's living and/or working overseas. Now, who are NI Connections? They are the diaspora department of InvestNI, and their mission is really, really simple. It's to connect the Northern Irish community all around the world. They put together some really incredible resources, including how to move you and your family back home if you haven't lived overseas, how to move to Northern Ireland for the first time, and even how to move your business or open up a new branch in this wonderful place that we call home. You'll also can find hundreds of interviews and profiles with fascinating people who are proud to call this place home. And you can check out all of these things and sign up for their free email newsletter at niconnections.com. Thanks very much. And I hope you enjoy the rest of today's episode. So number one, what an interesting story. What an interesting transformation in and of itself that you're going to a careers fair and it's a bit of a ghost town, bit of a tumbleweed. You go to a careers fair now, and it's like, you know, the students are like the celebrities. You know what I mean? People are like rushing. They're like, please take this flyer. Like, please take this free swag.
Absolutely. I mean, it's completely different. And, you know, I look back now in the work that I'm doing now and have contributed in some way to that change with my colleagues. And it's fantastic. I mean, I love the fact that when, you know, kids come out of university now, most of them have a job or have a choice of career. And there's nothing that I feel that changes the trajectory of somebody's life other than education and a good job. And, you know, that's one of the things that keeps me going in the job that I do today.
Yeah. So you kind of, just a small comment you made, you said, you know, keen. Are you a go-getter? Are you super keen? Where does your keenness come from? Maybe that's a better way to phrase that.
I don't know is the answer. I just know that, I suppose, from that time, I was always keen to find opportunities. Mm-hmm. You know, people talk about wanting to leave Northern Ireland, and they had to leave, and they were, you know, encouraged to do so. That was never me. I mean, I wasn't running away from Northern Ireland. I just wanted to explore the world, and I always had this keenness to see exotic places, different places. And there's a German word, and I'm going to butcher this pronunciation, basically called Fernweh. And it's an ick for distant places. And I think I always had that ick, even as a small child.
Yeah.
And it was more about, I suppose I was just, I loved movies, watching the movies and seeing these far off places and TV programs and everything. And I wanted to go those places, you know. So for me, a lot of the keenness coming out of university was more about, I want to travel the world.
The ache for distant places.
Yeah,
I think it's a great word. Gorgeous, isn't it?
I think it's a great word. And it's something even more than wanderlust, because I think we all, this part of the world, have this sense of wanderlust. But yeah, that sort of ache of wanting to be, you know, somewhere else, somewhere different, I think is really what's
important. And, you know, if you think back to girlhood, was there anything in particular, like, was it one show? Was it one book? Did you have a poster in your room? Was there like a big activation moment?
No, there wasn't one of any of those things. But I do remember, this is going to sound really bizarre, but I was a big fan of Charlie's Angels, the original Charlie's Angels.
Nice.
And I remember at one stage, they were in San Francisco for some reason. And one of the shots in the TV show was the sun setting over the Golden Gate Bridge. And I remember thinking, someday I would love to go across that bridge. And on the day that I flew into San Francisco for the first time, so I'd never been to America, this was my first time, I remember we were coming in just about sunset, and I looked out the window, and San Francisco is a beautiful city, and seeing, you know, the Transamerica building and all the rest of it. But then I saw the Golden Gate Bridge, and the sun was just setting on the bridge, and I thought, yes.
Goosebumps,
yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, it was amazing, yeah. So there's been, I think, just that of I want to do that someday has really spurred me on.
There is something about setting your sights on specific things.
Yeah.
And it's really weird when that happens.
It is, and it's kind of, I don't know, people talk about, you know, sending it out to the universe, and I guess I was doing that because many of the things that have happened to me, I feel almost have happened by chance, but I suppose you make a lot of those opportunities, absolutely, a lot of those chances, and it's whether or not you choose to take them.
Big time. Well, I heard something recently that I loved. It said, sometimes faith that moved the mountains looks like walking towards a big rock with a pickaxe in your hand.
Yeah, that's incredible.
You know what I mean? It's like there's really something about, you can't just have the vision. It's like there also has to be the action to follow that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it was kind of weird. I always had, even as a child, for some reason, I always had in my head the things I wanted to do in terms of even school. So you recently had the principal of Lurton College on. He talked about the Dixon Plan.
That's right.
And so I was part of the Dixon Plan as well. And I remember sitting in my primary school overlooking kind of the hills towards what would be ultimately my grammar school. And it was a rainy day and the lights were on in the grammar school. I went, yes, I want to go there someday. I could see it on the hill, and you know, from my window in primary school. And the same about going to Queen's. And in some ways, I got to Queen's and graduated and got to America, and then I went, oh, I haven't really thought about what's next. You know, I hadn't, you know, but I sort of rolled with whatever came afterwards. But I think those early years, really randomly looking back now, I actually did have a bit of a weird plan. You
sure. Know? Something I respect, I mean, probably top five traits in people that I'm really attracted to is people who want something. Mm-hmm. You know, I think like to want something is a very pure desire.
Yeah.
And I actually find that a lot of times coming from this place, that's stifled a wee bit.
Yeah.
Maybe you're not allowed to want something, or, you know, just you stay with your porridge. You know, it's kind of like, it's keep your eyes down instead of lift your head up.
Absolutely.
Why, like, if you're, you know, psychoanalyze yourself, if you look at your history, look at your background, like, you know, is it just built into you, or where does it come from?
I think a little bit. And I think also, you know, I have a really great family. And, you know, if I was coming up with crazy ideas, no one ever said to me, oh, stupid idea, you know, catch yourself on. I was like, okay, good, yeah, whatever, yeah, you go for it, kind of thing, you know. But to your point, I do think sometimes both ourselves and others put certain restrictions on us. And I remember when, you know, you were at sort of secondary school and you're talking about careers planning and planning what courses you're going to study and all the rest of it. And at the time, I guess it was a form of psychometric test we all had to do, where you had to answer lots of questions about what was, you know, your passion and what did you want to do. And you literally had to fill in a little card and you scribble in the dots and all that. And it went off somewhere and it came back with a report to say, these are the careers that you should follow, that you're best suited to. And of course, on the day the reports came back, we were all very excited. We're in the assembly hall and my friends were all, you know, be a doctor, be a lawyer, be an accountant, whatever it was. And I opened my report and it said, be a diplomat.
No way.
I swear.
Are you serious?
Yeah, it did. And I remember my friend looked over my shoulder and looked and went, diplomat? People like us don't become diplomats.
Yo.
Right? And then roll on, I guess, 20 years later, and I opened my passport and my first diplomatic passport or visa was in the passport. So people like us do become diplomats, but I think that's that, even that sense of people like us don't do something.
Yes.
I think I always kind of railed against in many ways. Maybe, I don't even know if it was consciously, but I didn't want there to be those restrictions or that you had to follow a certain path, you know. And so I didn't set out to ultimately become a diplomat, but it came because of decisions that I made along the way, you know. So
we talk a lot about culture, like as a team, and also just because we're really interested in Northern Ireland, obviously. Yeah. And Seth Godin, he's upstate New York, great author, speaker, etc. His definition of culture is people like us do things like this. And I really like to push up against, as you've described, that Northern Irish culture that says people like us do things like this, aka we don't do things like move to San Francisco. We don't do things like become an astronaut.
Yeah.
You know, I probably, at this point, Daniel said every single interview, that postcard up there has a wee quote on it from Sarah Fryer, and it says, you can't be what you can't see.
And I am a huge believer in that.
I knew we'd have fun today. I really am.
There's just... I used to do a lot of work with Young Enterprise before I left.
Actually, didn't know that.
Yeah, wow. No, I did, and I actually mentored some kids at schools and so on.
I'm a product of Young Enterprise.
There you go. Yeah. And today I still, you know, still support them. I think it's an amazing organization, and you know, we have a lot of their young entrepreneurs come out to the US, and you know, we speak with them. But I'm a big believer that kids need to see somebody and role model. I'm always a bit uncomfortable with the idea of role models as such, but I do think that young people do need to see that no matter where you do come from or your background or whatever it is, that you can be anything you want if you set your mind to it and you take those opportunities. And so, you know, I'm very conscious when I'm talking to young people to sort of say, like, you know, 20, 30 years ago, I was sitting where you're sitting right now. I mean, the thought of you know, living in New York, meeting the people I've met, going to the White House, whatever. I mean, it would have been so ridiculous. And there's nothing extraordinary about me or nothing special about me. I was just me coming from my background. And if I can do it, you can do it. And I think, you know, all along the way in my life, I've seen other people who've made those steps. Like, you know what? That gives me encouragement to try to do what they have done, you know? So,
and I actually think on the individual level, there is actually a short window of, this is maybe a strange thing to say, of like insane competitive advantage, where because not a lot of people break through the mold in Northern Ireland, if you're even like a tiny bit brave, you can actually reap unbelievable benefits from being the, you know, one of the ones that's brave enough to kind of step out.
I think that's true. And I think, you know, young people now are much braver, I think, than I was, or, you know, my peer group would have been at the time. But having said that, you know, I look around the folks that I went to school with, and, you know, you see somebody like Celine McStravick, who's now the chief executive of NICFI here, and Fiona Perry, she's an amazing author and poet. And we were all in class together in Lurgan, you know. Nice. And so we all did different things, but again, broke out of maybe the mold that was maybe destined for us, I suppose.
Yeah, big up Lurgan once
big
again.
Big up Lurgan.
So you have this kind of, you've shared, I think, two of them so far, where you kind of have this idea in your head of, I want to see the Golden Gate Bridge at sunset. And then you see that. Yeah. And when that happens to you, something happens inside that you're like, oh, what else could I do?
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
you shared the diplomat thing as well. Mm. All of a sudden, you got the diplomat visa in your passport. You're like, oh.
Yeah.
It's like that. It breeds a certain confidence that's quite exciting.
I think it is. And, you know, the diplomatic thing, I suppose I'd forgotten about it, was in the back of my head, but obviously it still was there mm-hmm. some way, you know, that when she said that to me, that people like us don't do, like, you know, and it bothered me and obviously still bothers me today. I'm still talking about it. But I don't know. I suppose fate plays a big part, mm-hmm. but I do feel it takes you maybe to a crossroads and then you've got to decide, you know, what route you're going to take, or a fork in the road, and you've got to decide where to go with it. But again, back to, you know, having the family, people that I knew that were supportive. So even if I had sort of messed up, you know, I would always that to fall back on sure. as well. So, I don't know. I've been very lucky, I think, in life generally, you know, and yes, you do make your luck as well. But I've been really fortunate for the people that I've met and the opportunities that I've had, and long may that last.
Absolutely. So San Fran in the 90s in comparison to Lurgan.
Yeah, a little bit different. I mean, we've just come out of the troubles, you know, literally. I think the first ceasefire had just happened whenever I headed out to San Francisco about a year later. And, you know, Lurgan was badly hit by the troubles, and invariably that impacted on everybody's life. San Francisco it might as well have been on the moon. I mean, it was just completely different, just completely different experience, different people, you know, different sites. But I was there with a group of about 14 people from Northern Ireland. We had a ball. I still run into many of those people, you know, today. I mean, it's typical Northern Ireland's 2 degrees of separation, sure, you know. But yeah, I mean, we for 6 months, we just had an incredible time and traveled around. And at that stage was the thing called a Delta Pass, which basically you bought it up front. I think it was like $500 or something. And essentially you could try, once you initiated it, you could travel standby on any flight to any city. That was it. And so every Friday night, there's four or five of us. You used to go to the airport in San Francisco. And we're like, okay, where are we going to go this week? Oh, we'll go to Vegas, or we'll go to New York, or we'll go to whatever. So it was a really incredible life for young 20-something-year-olds who had just come from Northern Ireland, come from that kind of background of conflict, and we were all from different backgrounds and all the rest of it. So again, really eye-opening experience, and I was very, very fortunate to get on. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so what sort of skills were you refining and developing in those days that you now clearly see, oh, I've got all these things in my tool belt now?
I think the biggest thing in terms of the work that I do now is just the ability to walk into a room and talk to people that you just don't know. I know that you spoke recently to Kingsley Aikens, Mr. Diaspora, but, you know, Kingsley, I know we'll talk about introverts and extroverts and omniverts. Something like that. And I think I probably fall into that category. So I remember I recently said to somebody, you know, at heart, I'm an introvert. And they were like, you know, catch yourself on.
Yeah.
But I actually feel in many ways that I am, because I don't get my energy from being around people all the time. There are parts of my life where I have to go and take some time to myself and just re-energize again. But I spent my life in front of people. Mm. You know, I spent my life walking into rooms of hundreds of people I don't know and talking to people on stage, giving presentations on panels or whatever it is. And I think actually in the job that I do, being an introvert or an omnivert, whatever I actually am, is probably a good thing, because I always need to find something that's interesting about other people to get that hook. And I think over the years, then, those are the skills that I was developing. How do you walk into your room and talk to people that you don't know and feel comfortable enough to do that? And how do you get people talking about themselves and talking about their needs? And so in the work that I do, especially the foreign direct investment work that I do, I remember when I got the job with InvestNI and speaking to my predecessor, and she literally walked into the room and sat down this lever arch file of prospects of companies that I should be targeting. And I opened the first page and it's all these massive US investment banks. And I'm thinking, how on earth am I going to walk into Goldman Sachs or something and have a coherent conversation with their chief executive? It seemed ridiculous. But again, you fall back on, you just treat people as you would hope to be treated yourself. And when you walk in the room, you want to make it about that person and have them talking about themselves and talking about the pain that they're maybe having within their company, so that we can turn that around into, okay, well, you have this pain, you have this problem. Well, we have this offering, we have this solution. And so I think those are the skills that I was building up over those years.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I mean, it is an amazing ability to have. it's a very fun ability to have. Like, it's a fun superpower.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. So I think sometimes you don't recognize it as being, you know, a really useful skill set, but it is.
Sure.
And I couldn't do the work that I do without it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing a Dan Sullivan entrepreneurial coaching program thing at the minute, and mm-hmm. they talk about unique ability. Uh-huh. One of the things about your unique ability is that it feels so easy to you that it's very easy for you to discredit it.
Yeah.
Because it comes so naturally. You're like, oh, no, that's not impressive. But actually, if you talk to the person next to you, they're like, no, that's like the most impressive thing ever. I could never do that.
Well, I think back to, you know, the Queen's Careers Fair all those years ago, and the only company that was there was Nortel. And we were talking to the guys, and they said, yeah, we're looking for salespeople. And I'm like, oh, I don't want to get into sales. That's mm-hmm. the last thing I want to do. And I spent... got 30 years doing sales, you know, so looking back on it now, you know, it seems crazy, but, you know, essentially that's what I do. I don't really like the term, but I sell Northern Ireland,
you
know,
you
and promote it and as a great place to work, to visit, to invest, to be educated. And it is so great to see Northern Ireland on that world stage now and to see all of these incredible companies who've come here and they've set up their bases here and are thriving, but also really amazing to see the entrepreneurial spirit now in Northern Ireland really thriving and so many local Indigenous, really cool, innovative Northern Ireland companies doing mm-hmm. so well internationally. Mm-hmm. And it's a real privilege to do what I do.
It's a very exciting role. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, before we started rolling, like it feels like for the last 3 years, they've been like, gotta talk to Andrea, like da da da. And I've kind of looked in from afar and I'm kind of like, I think I would like to do that job. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, so we just need to get you a little portable microphone and you can actually just do the...
I just do these box pops and walk around.
Yeah.
We get to meet some incredible people. You know, I arrived in New York on a Friday evening on the Monday morning, like first thing I was sitting in front of, you know, a guy on a trading floor in New York who was from Newcastle County Down.
Brilliant.
And he's a super guy, John O'Donohue, and he's still a great friend and mentor to me now. But I remember throughout our meeting, and he laughs about this, tells everybody about this now, but he was ranting and raving. You know, the trading floor is outside his office. I'm in the office. As we're meeting, he's still on the phone to the guys out on the floor, shouting at them. And, you know, and it was all very like, this is, should I really be here? Should I maybe leave? You know, and we continued our meeting. And, you know, he offered me great insight and support even at that stage. And at the end of the meeting, he just went, I said something like, oh, I hope it's okay, you know, out there. And he went, oh, they just lost 2 million, it's fine. You know, so this is a whole other world, you know. But I've had tremendous support from people from Northern Ireland who are over there and those who just have a really strong connection and affinity with the place. And, you know, many of the successes that we've brought here have been down to the support of our diaspora. So, again, a very cool opportunity to meet and mingle and work with people who are from here and want the best for the place. You
know? Yeah, totally. So New York, talk a bit about New York. What do you like about it? What do you like about it? Where do you live? Where do you like to go for fun?
I live in Manhattan, so I'm very lucky. I live right downtown. And when I moved downtown, I'm in New York 16 years. And when I was going over, people said to me, oh, you know, you're going to go Upper West Side, Upper East Side. You're going to go out to Queens. What are you going to do? I hadn't a clue. And I really struggled to get an apartment. I went over sort of around about August time. And so at that stage, it's when a lot of the school kids are looking for apartments and everything else. So it's really hard to get an apartment. And a friend of mine, I remember walking through an underground car park and phoning her, I can't find anywhere to live. And she said, oh, I think there's maybe an apartment in this building. Why don't you look at it? And it was downtown. I'm like, oh, no, I live downtown. Nobody wanted to live downtown.
Sure.
At that stage. But anyway, I went along to the apartment and there were two apartments that I looked at. And I actually had to come back to Northern Ireland pretty quickly to do an Invest in Ice International conference. So I had a very small window to sort myself out. Mm-hmm. And it was around Labor Day holiday. So it was sort of end of August, beginning of September. And people said to me, you should go to Macy's and get your bed sorted out because that's really important. So you literally arrive over there with nothing,
sure.
You know. And every apartment, you literally need everything from a spoon till a bed, right? So you need the whole works. So I took their advice, went off to Macy's for their big mattress sale and chose whatever I was choosing. And the lady said to me, give me your address. And it was like, okay. And I literally blurted out the apartment building and one of the apartments I'd seen. I couldn't even remember what the apartment looked like. And I remember walking in the first day and went, oh, all right, yeah, this is, oh, yeah, I remember it now. This is so I lived downtown, said I would do that for a year just to get my bearings. Our office is off Wall Street, so
oh,
it's downtown
good.
As well.
Cool.
So, again, it was great from a commuting point of view, and I haven't left downtown.
Unreal.
And I love it. You know, it's kind of it's now become very trendy.
Sure.
But at that stage, it really was, live downtown.
Yeah. What year was this?
That would have been 2007.
Okay, yeah.
And so I literally live in the shadow of the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
So when I see a lot of documentaries now about 9/11 and so on, it's really spooky for me because I'm literally seeing my neighborhood.
Mm.
But I'm right by the waterfront. I'm right by Battery Park. And, you know, during times, for example, like COVID, when New York was getting absolutely battered, it was an absolute godsend to have the park and to have the waterfront at a time where, you know, you're living in very small spaces in New York and the world is crazy. So I love it. I love living downtown.
Yeah. It's so funny though, like if you think about growing up over here and it's like now it's like a few minutes outside your door, you're looking at the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, you know what
I
mean? Literally.
It's every so day I look funny.
I have a little dog, Bailey, and I take him to the park every morning, and every morning I look at the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah.
And it's the one thing that I remember too. It's a bit like that flight across to San Francisco. On that flight, I was the person who was visiting America for the first time. This was a big deal for me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm on a flight or I'm in the park and I see kids running in and, oh, the Statue of Liberty. And I remember, like, you get a bit immune to it because it's there for me every day. But for lots of those kids and other people, they're seeing it for the first time. And this is life-changing for them. This is something they've always wanted to do, you know. So I remember during COVID, I used to go to the park every morning, about 7 a.m. every morning, and I was the only person there because so many people had left the city. So over 400,000 people left New York in the first 3 months of COVID. And, you know, the place was like a ghost town. It really was very strange. But this morning I was walking in, it was dark, dreary morning, and I had my dog, and I was walking into the park. When I walk in, I pretty much have the water right in front of me and the Statue of Liberty right in front of me in the distance. And this morning, it wasn't there. There was something there, but not what should be there. And it was really disorientating.
Mm.
And but as I got closer and closer, I realized that it was one of the hospital ships that had sailed into New York Harbor. And in the park that morning, it was coming through this gray mistiness and this big white ship with a red cross on it. And the only other people in the park, there were cops that were always there every morning doing their thing. And then there was like three or four people on the other side of the waterfront, and somebody had an American flag and was flying the flag, and somebody started to sing God Bless America. And still to this day, it kind of gives me goosebumps because it was, again, the most surreal moment walking into the park and, as I said, the Statue of Liberty not being there, but the hospital ship being there instead. And I think that just emphasized what a really terrible situation that we were in.
Yeah. I mean, think everywhere got hit hard from, like, as you know, I lived in New York for 3 years, and looking on from a distance, you're just looking at the city and this, it just seems like the city's disintegrating before your eyes.
Yeah.
How has it bounced back, would you say?
I think it's bounced back a lot. When the tourists started to come back, it changed things a lot. I mean, it's very hard to imagine Times Square not having anybody in it. There are people in Times Square at every hour of the day. And I have a friend who's a photographer, and he obviously wasn't working during that period at all. There were no events, there were nothing, you know, but he took a lot of images around the city of what it was like during COVID, and to see his images now, it's kind of shocking, you know, to see empty streets in Times Square, you know, just literally nobody around. I remember walking down Wall Street one evening, it was dark, it had been raining, and there was no one around. And then all of a sudden these three guys appeared out of nowhere in hazmat suits walking down the street. So it was a very strange time. Today, the tourists have come back, and certainly where I live, because I'm near the Statue of Liberty, I'm near the Charging Bull, all those things, there's always a lot of tourists in that area. But there's still elements of the city that haven't come back. So there's still a lot of boarded up hotels, for example, that have not reopened. People are still mostly working remotely.
Mm-hmm.
I would say people come into the office more here than they actually do in New York.
Interesting.
There's a bit of a push to get people back, but, you know, downtown where our office is, just off Wall Street, a lot of the office buildings are now being converted into residential buildings because folks are not returning to the office. So it hasn't fully returned to the old New York, but New York is New York. There's always that kind of buzz and that sort of frisson that you just don't get anywhere else.
Sure.
You
know? Where in New York do you get your Northern Irish fix when you need one, want one?
So my local is the Dead Rabbit.
Great. So what a local.
I know, right?
Bar in the world.
Best bar in the world. And Jack McGarry is doing an amazing job there. And, you know, he's opening other Dead Rabbits around the US. I was just recently in Austin, saw his new bar there. It hasn't opened yet, but saw the the site, and I think he's doing New Orleans as well coming up. He's just opened a bar in Penn Station.
Is he really?
Yeah, incredible.
Wow, I didn't
hear
that.
So he's just opened that very, very recently. So he's doing amazing work. So that is my Northern Irish fix. I literally can walk around the corner and the Dead Rabbit is there.
Nice.
Which is fantastic. And then I run a team of about 30 people across the Americas, and many of the folks are originally from Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. And so again, I'm getting my fix every day. So I'm trying to keep the accent. I think my father would argue that I've gone very Yankified, but for the most part, I think every day I'm speaking with people from here, yeah. whether it's people in my own team or people on the phone or whatever. And that's where I get my fix for
it's great.
Northern Ireland.
I think it's an English place, but we always would go to Salt and Battery in Chelsea.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And for things like Lucozade even, not even necessarily the fish and chips, but it's like those would be like random, like Vinto, you know, it's like things that you just can't get anywhere else. We lived on 191st Street, so Washington Heights.
Amazing, yeah.
So way up in the nosebleed section, as we often said. And there was a wee Irish pub there, and it's called like, Irish isn't great, like Le Chielli or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so, so nice. Yeah. And you go in there and, you know, there would be like, you know, people from Antrim serving you dinner and stuff. You're like, this is just class.
It is incredible. And even actually in a Salt and Battery, I was in there recently and it was a guy from here that's
oh, serious?
There. Yeah. So, I mean, we're everywhere, you know, we really are. And it's very cool for me, mm-hmm. you know, to welcome people over. And recently we had three female authors from Northern Ireland come over and share their work there. And again, great to see the support that there is from people from the sweet part of the world.
Okay, so you've obviously met a lot of people.
Yeah.
Any standouts? I'm not going to ask you to rank because that would just... if there's one thing I've learned podcasts, never ask people to rank things because then it's just like the computer like malfunctions.
Yeah. Oh my goodness, what a question. I think George Mitchell, I think if you hear George Mitchell speak, he just takes your breath away every single time. He obviously, as you know, he was very involved in the signing of the Good Friday Agreement. And, you know, this year we celebrated 25 years of that. And so I was at a number of events this year in particular where he appeared. But way back when I came over first, I remember going to dinner one night and he told the story of his experience of Northern Ireland and working through the negotiations that led to the signing of the Good Friday Agreement and how much of his own personal life he sacrificed for here. And when you hear him tell the story, it does really take your breath away. And I was fortunate to be at the Queen's 25th anniversary conference back in April, and he spoke during that conference. He spoke for about 55 minutes, and it was the most amazing hair in the back of your neck speech you will ever hear. And I encourage anybody who hasn't heard it to go on YouTube and whatever and listen to it. But I just think he's the most impressive man, and he did so much good for here, and I could listen to him speak every single day.
So, you know, you're kind of in the trade of speaking and communicating. If you were to kind of, you know, dissect, analyze what makes George, if it's even permissible for me to dare just say his first name, you know, unpack it. What do you think makes him a great speaker?
I think he's just authentic. And I think he tells a very personal story.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not standing up there doing something that's very academic and rolling out a paper kind of thing. He's just telling it as it is. And he's telling it about, you know, how he left the negotiations to come back to the US to see his son being born and how he wasn't going to return to Northern Ireland because he didn't want to leave his newborn son and his wife. And it was his wife who said to him, no, you have to go back and finish this. You will regret it. And when you hear those stories and understand how much he personally sacrificed for a place that he had no connection to, I just think that personal story is just really, really impactful.
We chatted, I mean, just for a couple of minutes, just when you initially came in. Why is Northern Ireland so sticky? Like, you know, people, as you said, I'm using your words, you know, they come here on holiday, they come here for university, and a part of them never leaves.
Yeah.
That's not normal, you know, you and I have been to lots of different places around the world, met lots of different types of people, and it's not confirmation bias. It's not me being proud of where I'm from.
No,
it's like there's something very weird about the magnetism of the place, or I don't know.
And I'm not going to explain it because I don't know what it is.
Sure.
But, you know, to your point, I worked on a project with Aflac, an incredible US company who set up here in 2019. But we work with them, you know, I think what people don't understand is the projects that we work on, they can take 2-3 years longer maybe. So it's a long lead time. And they sent many of their senior executives across here. And the last guy who came was their CFO. He was actually the first person that I met at Affleck many moons ago. And I remember we were sitting having lunch and he said to me, there's just something about here. I can't tell you what it is, but there's just something about here. And this again was, you know, was a very senior businessman who had been around the world, was running this multi-million dollar corporation. And even he, after only being here probably a day, was saying there's something weird about it, but good weird. And Keith Farley, who ended up running the operation for the first few years, is from Georgia and, again, had no connections with here whatsoever. Loved it. He became Mr. Northern Ireland, you know, loves the place, has probably seen way more of it than I have seen. But there's a brilliant, yet another video that I encourage people to go see. But before he left, he just recently returned to Georgia. And before he left, he spoke at Belfast Harbour and he gave a speech about his experience of being in Northern Ireland. And essentially it was Northern Ireland is abnormal. And in many ways, again, it was reflecting back things that we take for granted. That we, for an outsider, is abnormal, but really good, you know, by the people. And most of it was driven by the people, how unique the people are, the fact that people will go that extra mile to help you, that they are loyal, that they are trustworthy, that they are innovative and resilient. And I think that that concept of resiliency is something that always comes through when you talk about people from Northern Ireland. You know, we've been through a lot over the years, and I think there's always that innate resiliency that's built into us. And that, again, ability to reinvent ourselves as well. Even if you look at the industries that we've, you know, had here that have led the world, you know, whether it be shipbuilding, rope making, way back when, to now where we are world leaders when it comes to things like cybersecurity and fintech and so on. We're just constantly reinventing ourselves to keep ourselves relevant.
Yeah. I mean, it's never not worked in my favor. Under like 10 different scenarios. You know, I used to do a lot of, when I was in New York, I did a lot of work with homelessness and gangs and drug addicts up in Harlem. I remember breaking up like street fights. And they heard the accent and they're like, where are you from? I'm like, Belfast. And they're like, respect. And I'm like, hang on a second. I'm actually from Lisburn. You know what I mean? It's like, but I'm telling you I'm from Belfast because no one knows where Lisburn is. Or on the business front, you know, people will meet you because you say you're from Northern Ireland. It gives you this, it's very, very strange, but I'm not complaining.
No, and I think people are always curious to hear your story. That's the other thing, you know, because for many, many years, they had these crazy images on the screen and some people still think in that way, but they want to hear your story. So again, you know, the work that I do is simply about telling stories. When, you know, when we approach a company about potentially coming and setting up in Northern Ireland, I think the first thing people don't realize is in the US, there are more than 10,000 economic development agencies like Invest in I. So we are competing every day with 10,000 other us's, if you know what I mean. And in New York City alone, there's 150 economic development agencies. So the competition is huge. And I think it's very difficult to maybe fathom that when you're here. So when we're trying to put somewhere like Northern Ireland on the map, a little tiny place where you're going up against much larger cities, countries, regions of the world. The thing that sets us apart often is our stories, our ability to tell stories. And so whenever I go in to meet a company, I don't really see it as a sales pitch. I see it as an opportunity to tell a story about Northern Ireland, about the success that other companies have had here, and to try and somehow relate that to a problem maybe that a company's having and how we could potentially solve that problem. So I think that ability for people to be interested, first of all, oh, you're from Northern Ireland. That's a bit strange. That's a bit different. You're a bit edgy, maybe.
Yeah, it's niche.
Yeah, it's very niche. And why on earth should I? I mean, in the business that I'm in, when it comes to foreign direct investment, especially, everybody has heard of Dublin, Manila, Mumbai. You know, those are the kind of the go-to offshore centers. Often they haven't heard of Northern Ireland. And so they're curious as to why on earth they would talk to somebody from Northern Ireland about setting up, you know, a center of excellence there. And so I have that ability to go in and tell a story. So I think in many ways it opens doors, the fact of where we are. But yeah, the competition is huge.
You're always the wild card is what I'm hearing.
I think that's the case. You know? And actually, you know, we talk to companies that we would recognize as multipliers or influencers. And often now why they, I guess, open a door for us is because they're bringing something different to the table and we are it. But they're comfortable enough that we've such a track record of success now with companies coming here and thriving and doing way more than they ever anticipated doing.
Yeah,
that they're confident enough to at least open that door and have us tell the stories.
Yeah. So those 10,000, I'm going to say Invest NI equivalents,
yeah.
There are different cities, different countries around the world. And there's so many of them, even in New York alone. And do you like see, will you see these other organizations at like the parties you go to, the dinners? Oh, yeah. And is it kind of like Gangs of New York? Do you know what I mean? Is it like, there's those Joburg people?
It kind of is a little bit in some ways, but it's really strange. And it's something I didn't know existed before I went, so why should anybody else know? But I remember being in the Czech Republic many moons ago at an offshoring conference, and we all had little booths. And quite honestly, if you just changed the name tag on each of our booths, nobody would have known, because we were all talking about the people, the place, you know, the cost, whatever it happened to be. And I remember coming back here and saying to the folks here, you have to give me something different, something that makes us stand apart.
Sure.
And I think ultimately it comes back to the people. It really does. And the skill set of the people and the training that we have here and all the rest of it. And so I do think when companies really do that due diligence and they go and investigate the offering that we put on the table, we tick the boxes, and it's about confidence building and trust. And so in any project that I've worked on, and as I say, they can take 3 years or more to fully form, there comes a point where the relationship between us and the potential investor is no longer just transactional.
Mm-hmm.
There's that trust. I can almost go back to the moment where I saw a change in the demeanor of the people that I was speaking to, where they now believe that you're not just putting statistics and in front of them. It's really that you genuinely want to do your best for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose what gives me the confidence to do that is because when we bring companies here, they have such an amazing experience.
Right.
And there has never been a company who's come to Northern Ireland in my time that has left because Northern Ireland didn't work out for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that gives you tremendous confidence to be able to go in there and say, we have done this for the other companies. We believe we're the right location for you.
Yeah.
So, it's a real privilege to be doing it.
But in sales, you know, we talk about conviction.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have conviction that actually the thing you're selling works.
And it does. And there's no way that you could do the job that we do without that conviction. And, you know, companies could go out. And we actually do say to some companies, we don't think we're the right fit for you.
Sure.
You know, we're very open about that as well. But to manage to get onto the radar when you are competing against those other 10,000 economic development agencies, you have to really believe in what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know,
I really love your story. And it's kind of back to the you can't be what you can't see. You know, when people think about doing something great for Northern Ireland, there might be a lot of things that comes into their head. And, you know, we talked about when you think about sales, you have a very particular thing in your head. If you think about, oh, I've got all these great interpersonal skills. Maybe I'm listening to this podcast and I work in hospitality. Maybe I'm listening to this podcast and actually, you know, I'm doing sales. I'm selling Velux windows or whatever it is. It's like those skills can be utilized to make a humongous impact for this part of the world.
Absolutely.
You know, and you've taken your skills, your love of place, and now you're on the front line of doing something really exciting and really meaningful.
Yeah, and I think that's it. I mean, I genuinely, when I took this job, if I'm being really honest with you, when I went for the job not really wanting it because I was really, I don't really want to work for the government. And but I missed the first job that I had. I spent my time 10 years almost traveling the world. And I missed that international aspect of the job. And so I wanted to do something again. And my initial thought was I would go work for a Northern Ireland company that was exporting and be their export marketing manager or something. And at the time, there just wasn't that opportunity. And this came up. And in a fit of pique when I had a bad day at the office or something, I fired in my CV to Invest in Life for this job. And again, not really understanding what it was and not really wanting it because I had this vision of a lot of bureaucracy and that's just not me. And anyway, I rolled on and I got through the interview process and they actually asked me to go to New York. And I think my thought process was, I'll go for a couple of years. Who's going to turn New York down for a couple of years, right? And I'm there 16 years later. And why am I there 16 years later is really because the job has constantly been evolving. But more importantly, there are very few jobs in this world, I think, where there's a real tangible outcome to what you're doing. But more importantly, you're having a real impact on people's lives and the community from which you come. And that's what drives me. So every time that we you know, when I was doing FDI, we got a deal. You wanted to get the next one because you saw the genuinely positive impact it had on people's lives. From a trade perspective, you know, when we help companies from Northern Ireland, yes, we work with some of the really big companies, but more often it's with the smaller artisanal type companies, you know, family-run businesses, for example. And, you know, very recently I was talking to our guys who are based in Mexico, and they were working with one of the balsamic vinegar companies that has sprouted up here. And they were telling me about how they brought the owners to a store in Mexico City to see their product on the shelves, and wow. They burst into tears. So you have such an impact on people's lives, mm-hmm. you know, and for them to see their vinegars on mm-hmm. the shelves was massively impactful. Will spur them on to do greater things, to expand and, you know, to employ more people, whatever it happens to be. So every day we have that ability to impact people's lives and change people's lives, which maybe sounds a bit cheesy or maybe a bit hyperbolic, but it's true, you know, mm-hmm. and I think that's why I've been there 16 years, is because
sure.
you give back.
100%. And as we kind of referenced earlier, it is, you know, you are part of the effort inside Invest and outside of Invest that has made a career fair, a ghost town to just an absolute surplus of opportunity for certain
it's,
types
it's
of people.
It's great, you know. Yeah.
If you could go out for a cup of coffee or wine or beer or whatever it is you like with someone from Northern Ireland, dead or alive, who would it be, where and why?
I have to go back to Lurgan, really, don't I?
Big up Lurgan.
Big up Lurgan again. There's a lady called Dame Joycelyn Bell Burnell, and she is an astrophysicist. And back in the 1970s, she discovered pulsars. And it was probably one of the biggest astronomical discoveries of the 20th century. And the research itself resulted in a Nobel Prize for physics. However, she didn't get recognized. And really came down to the fact that she was a woman and she was a graduate student. And so other people got the prize. But she didn't let that deter her. She continued to do amazing work, and still does, within the world of physics. A few years ago, she started to get more recognition for the work that she's been doing. And in 2018, she won a major physics prize that came with a purse of $3 million, I should say. And she donated all $3 million to inspiring the next generation of young women, minority communities, refugees, to get involved in physics and STEM. Mm. And she's still very passionate about getting women and girls into STEM, really because she feels that that will be transformational for them and for Northern Ireland, and in particular, the growing space sector that we have here. So I would love to meet Joycelyn Burnell, just because I think she has the most amazing story. She's from Lurgan, and again, she's someone who, if you can see it, you can be it.
Yeah.
And where would we go? Well, Armagh Planetarium, I guess. I think I know very little about space. I must have asked someone who should teach me something. But I think also her father was involved in designing the current planetarium.
Cool.
As far as I understand, it's the longest continuously operating planetarium in these islands. So I think it might be the place to go and grab a coffee or a cocktail or just talk about space.
It's brilliant. You've met a lot of people from Northern Ireland. Is there anyone on your list that you're kind of like, I still haven't met that person yet and I'd love to?
Well, you were that person till today. So I don't know. I mean, honestly, I am just blown away every day by the people that I meet from here and the incredible work that they're doing. Just as we came in here today, there's a startup company here in the Normal Baths. And they've just won, you know, a program, an opportunity to be on an accelerator program. And so meeting people like that every day who are doing incredibly cool things, mm-hmm. I'm a very lucky person.
It's brilliant. Yeah. While you're home for Christmas, is there like one quintessential Northern Irish thing that you just really, really want to do?
Oh, you know what? It's all about the food, really, isn't it? and it's not even about Christmas, to be honest with you. Every time we come home, and we talk about this in work, when people are going home, it's all about, you know, what Chinese are you going to tonight, mm-hmm. or what are you going to, it's all lined up. So it's all about the food. So I think, you know, grabbing a burger, chip and cofolas and Lurgan is probably high up there on my list of cravings.
Amazing. Class. Someone remind me to tell the story off mic whenever we finish about Tato crisps. Don't think I can say it on mic, but you'll get a good laugh out of this. It's really, really funny. Final question then. Mm-hmm. I think this is where we are. If you could go back in time to... How old were you when you moved to San Fran?
22.
If you could go back in time to a 22-year-old version of yourself,
yeah,
you had a couple of minutes, what sort of things would you be saying?
I would just say roll with the opportunities. Do what you're doing now. You know, I think maybe I go further back to that point where, you know, my friend said, oh, people like us don't do. I think I would just say to that person and said, anybody that's in that situation today, you can do anything you want to do. You know, if the opportunity comes your way, take it. Especially when you're young, you know, I you'll never regret taking an opportunity. You'll always regret the ones that you've missed out on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think today, I would say also be comfortable being uncomfortable. I think all of us get to a point where maybe we stop learning new things because mm-hmm. we don't want to be bad at them and, you know, look stupid. But I think by continually being uncomfortable, you also are continually learning and stretching yourself and I suppose optimizing the skills that you have. So, yeah, never let anybody tell you or pigeonhole you or tell you what you can't do. Yeah.
Andrea, it's the final interview of the year and it's an absolute delight. Thank you so, so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Really enjoyed it.
And I'll go out in January, but Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
But that's a wrap.
Is that okay?
That was epic. Amazing stuff. Just want to give one final thanks to NI Connections for making today's episode possible. You can sign up for their free email newsletter at niconnections.com where you'll get straight to your inbox interesting stories from people who are from this place but are living and working overseas. You'll also get some really interesting insider information about best practices of how to move back home or how to start a business here and all this other really, really interesting stuff. NIconnections.com is the place to do that. And we're so, so grateful that we're able to keep this series going thanks to NI Connections support. Have a great rest of your day. And thank you so much for checking out the podcast. Cheers.